Save on O'Reilly Brake Parts Cleaner. Get two cans of O'Reilly Brake Parts Cleaner for just $8. Valid in-store only at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Part 3 of Bartleby the Scrivener. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Bob Neufeld. Bartleby the Scrivener, A Story of Wall Street, by Herman Melville. Part 3. He remained as ever a fixture in my chamber. Nay, if that were possible, he became still more of a fixture than before. What was to be done? He would do nothing in the office. Why should he stay there? In plain fact, he had now become a millstone to me, not only useless as a necklace, but afflictive to bear. Yet I was sorry for him. I speak less than truth when I say that, on his own account, he occasioned me uneasiness. If he would have but named a single relative or friend, I would instantly have written, and urged their taking the poor fellow away to some convenient retreat. But he seemed alone, absolutely alone in the universe, a bit of wreck in the mid-Atlantic. At length, necessities connected with my business tyrannized over all other considerations. Decently as I could, I told Bartleby that in 6 days' time he must unconditionally leave the office. I warned him to take measures, in the interval, for procuring some other abode. I offered to assist him in this endeavor, if he himself would but take the first step towards a removal. "And when you finally quit me, Bartleby," added I shall see that you go not away entirely unprovided. 6 days from this hour, remember." At the expiration of that period, I peeped behind the screen, and lo, Bartleby was there. I buttoned up my coat, balanced myself, advanced slowly towards him, touched his shoulder, and said, "The time has come. You must quit this place. I am sorry for you. Here is money. You must go." "I would prefer not," he replied, with his back still towards me.
"You must."
He remained silent. Now, I had an unbounded confidence in this man's common honesty. He had frequently restored to me sixpences and shillings carelessly dropped upon the floor, for I am apt to be very reckless in such shirt-button affairs. The proceeding, then, which followed, will not be deemed extraordinary. "Bartleby," said I owe you $12 on account. Here are 32. The odd 20 are yours. Will you take it?" And I handled the bills towards him. But he made no motion. "I will leave them here, then," putting them under a weight on the table. Then, taking my hat and cane and going to the door, I tranquilly turned and added, "After you have removed your things from these offices, Bartleby, you will of course lock the door, since everyone is now gone for the day but you, and, if you please, slip your key underneath the mat, so that I may have it in the morning. I shall not see you again. So, good-bye to you. If hereafter, in your new place of abode, I can be of any service to you, do not fail to advise me by letter. Good-bye, Bartleby, and fare you well." But he answered not a word. Like the last column of some ruined temple, he remained standing mute and solitary in the middle of the otherwise deserted room. As I walked home in a pensive mood, my vanity got the better of my pity. I could not but highly plume myself on my masterly management in getting rid of Bartleby. Masterly, I call it, and such it must appear to any dispassionate thinker.
The beauty of my procedure seemed to consist in its perfect quietness. There was no vulgar bullying, no bravado of any sort, no choleric hectoring and striding to and fro across the apartment, jerking out vehement commands for Bartleby to bundle himself up with his beggarly traps. Nothing of the kind. Without loudly bidding Bartleby depart, as an inferior genius might have done, I assumed the ground that depart he must, and upon that assumption built all I had to say. The more I thought about my procedure, the more I was charmed with it. Nevertheless, next morning, upon awakening, I had my doubts. I had somehow slept off the fumes of vanity. One of the coolest and wisest hours a man has is just after he awakes in the morning. My procedure seemed as sagacious as ever, but only in theory. How it would prove in practice, there was the rub. It was truly a beautiful thought to have assumed Bartleby's departure, but after all that assumption was simply my own, and none of Bartleby's. The great point was not whether I had assumed that he would quit me, but whether he would prefer so to do. He was more of a man of preferences than assumptions. After breakfast I walked downtown, arguing the probabilities pro and con. One moment I thought it would prove a miserable failure, and Bartleby would be found all alive at my office as usual. The next moment it seemed certain that I should see his chair empty. And so I kept veering about. At the corner of Broadway and Canal Street I saw quite an excited group of people standing in earnest conversation. "I'll take odds he doesn't," said a voice as I passed. "Doesn't go?" "Done," said I. "Put up your money." I was instinctively putting my hand in my pocket to produce my own, when I remembered that this was an election day. The words I had overheard bore no reference to Bartleby, but to the success or non-success of some candidate for the mayoralty. In my intent frame of mind, I had, as it were, imagined that all Broadway shared in my excitement, and were debating the same question with me. I passed on, very thankful that the uproar of the street screened my momentary absent-mindedness. As I had intended, I was earlier than usual at my office door. I stood listening for a moment. All was still. He must be gone. I tried the knob. The door was locked. Yes, my procedure had worked to a charm. He indeed must be vanished. Yet a certain melancholy mixed with this. I was almost sorry for my brilliant success. I was fumbling under the doormat for the key, which Bartleby was to have left there for me, when accidentally my knee knocked against a panel, producing a summoning sound, and in response a voice came to me from within. "Not yet. I am occupied." It was Bartleby. I was thunderstruck. For an instant I stood like the man who, pipe in mouth, was killed one cloudless afternoon long ago in Virginia by a summer lightning. At his own warm open window he was killed, and remained leaning out there upon the dreamy afternoon till someone touched him, when he fell. "Not gone," I murmured at last, but again obeying that wondrous ascendancy which the inscrutable scrivener had over me, and from which ascendancy, for all my chafing, I could not completely escape, I slowly went downstairs and out into the street, and while walking round the block, considered what I should next do in this unheard-of perplexity. Turn the man out by an actual thrusting I could not. To drive him away by calling him hard names would not do. Calling in the police was an unpleasant idea, And yet, permit him to enjoy his cadaverous triumph over me, this too I could not think of. What was to be done? Or, if nothing could be done, was there anything further that I could assume in the matter? Yes, as before I had prospectively assumed that Bartleby would depart, so now I might retrospectively assume that departed he was. In the legitimate carrying out of this assumption, I might enter my office in a great hurry, and pretending not to see Bartleby at all, walk straight against him as if he were air. Such a proceeding would, in a singular degree, have the appearance of a home thrust. It was hardly possible that Bartleby could withstand such an application of the doctrine of assumptions. But, upon second thought, the success of the plan seemed rather dubious. I resolved to argue the matter over with him. "Bartleby," said I, entering the office with a quietly severe expression, "I am seriously displeased. I am pained, Bartleby. I had thought better of you. I had imagined you of such a gentlemanly organization that in any delicate dilemma a slight hint would have sufficed, in short, an assumption. But it appears I am deceived." "Why," I added, unaffectedly starting, "you have not even touched that money yet," pointing to it just where I had left it the evening previous. He answered nothing. "Will you or will you not quit me?" I now demanded in a sudden passion, advancing close to him.
"I would prefer not to quit you," he replied, gently emphasizing the "not."
"What earthly right have you to stay here? Do you pay rent? Do you pay my taxes? Or is this property yours?"
He answered nothing.
"Are you ready to go on and write now? Are your eyes recovered? Could you copy a small paper for me this morning, or help examine a few lines, or step round to the post-office? In a word, will you do anything at all to give a colouring to your refusal to depart the premises?" He silently retired into his hermitage. I was now in such a state of nervous resentment that I thought it but prudent to check myself at present from further demonstrations. Bartleby and I were alone. I remembered the tragedy of the unfortunate Adams, and the still more unfortunate Colt in the solitary office of the latter, and how poor Colt, being dreadfully incensed by Adams, and imprudently permitting himself to get wildly excited, was at unawares hurried into his fatal act, an act which certainly no man could possibly deplore more than the actor himself. Often it had occurred to me in my ponderings upon the street, that had that altercation taken place in the public street, or at a private residence, it would not have terminated as it did. It was the circumstance of being alone in a solitary office, upstairs, of a building entirely unhallowed by humanizing domestic associations, an uncarpeted office, doubtless of a dusty, haggard sort of appearance. This it must have been which greatly helped to enhance the irritable desperation of the hapless Colt. But when this old Adam of resentment rose in me and tempted me concerning Bartleby, I grappled him and threw him. How? Why, simply by recalling the divine injunction, "A new commandment give I unto you, that ye love one another." Yes, this it was that saved me. Aside from higher considerations, charity often operates as a vastly wise and prudent principle, a great safeguard to its possessor. Men have committed murder for jealousy's sake, and anger's sake, and hatred's sake, and selfishness' sake, and spiritual pride's sake. But no man that ever I heard of ever committed a diabolical murder for sweet charity's sake. Mere self-interest, then, if no better motive can be enlisted, should, especially with high-tempered men, prompt all beings to charity and philanthropy. At any rate, upon the occasion in question, I strove to drown my exasperated feelings towards the scrivener by benevolently construing his conduct. Poor fellow, thought I, he didn't mean anything, and besides, he has seen hard times, and ought to be indulged. I endeavored also immediately to occupy myself, and at the same time to comfort my despondency. I tried to fancy that in the course of the morning, at such time as might prove agreeable to him, Bartleby, of his own free accord, would emerge from his hermitage and take up some decided line of march in the direction of the door. But no. 12:30 came, Turkey began to glow in the face, overturn his inkstand, and become generally obstreperous. Nippers abated down into quietude and courtesy. Gingernut munched his noon apple. And Bartleby remained standing at his window in one of his profoundest dead-wall reveries. Will it be credited? Ought I to acknowledge it? That afternoon I left the office without saying any further word to him. Some days now passed, during which, at leisure intervals, I looked a little into Edwards on the Will and Priestley on Necessity. Under the circumstances, those books induced a salutary feeling. Gradually, I slid into the persuasion that these troubles of mind touching the scrivener had been all predestinated from eternity, and Bartleby was billeted upon me for some mysterious purpose of an all-wise providence, which it was not for a mere mortal like me to fathom. Yes, Bartleby, stay here beyond your screen, thought I. I shall persecute you no more. You are harmless and noiseless as any of these old chairs. In short, I never feel so private as when I know you are here. At last I see it, I feel it, I penetrate to the predestined purpose of my life. I am content. Others may have loftier parts to enact, but my mission in this world, Bartleby, is to furnish you with an office room for such period as you may see fit to remain. I believe that this wise and blessed frame of mind would have continued with me, had it not been for the unsolicited and uncharitable remarks obtruded upon me by my professional friends who visited the rooms. But thus it often is that the constant friction of illiberal minds wears out at last the best resolves of the more generous. Though, to be sure, when I reflected upon it, it was not strange that people entering my office should be struck by the peculiar aspect of the unaccountable Bartleby, and so be tempted to throw out some sinister observations concerning him. Sometimes an attorney having business with me, and calling at my office, and finding no one but the scrivener there, would undertake to obtain some sort of precise information from him touching my whereabouts. But without heeding his idle talk, Bartleby would remain standing immovable in the middle of the room. So, after contemplating him in that position for a while, the attorney would depart, no wiser than he came. Also, when a reference was going on, and the room full of lawyers and witnesses, and business was driving fast, some deeply occupied legal gentleman present, seeing Bartleby wholly unemployed, would request him to run round to his, the legal gentleman's, office, and fetch some papers for him. Thereupon Bartleby would tranquilly decline, and yet remain idle as before. Then the lawyer would give a great stare, and turn to me. And what could I say? at last I was made aware that all through the circle of my professional acquaintance a whisper of wonder was running round, having reference to the strange creature I kept at my office. This worried me very much, and as the idea came upon me of his possibly turning out a long-lived man, and keep occupying my chambers, and denying my authority, and perplexing my visitors, and scandalizing my professional reputation, and casting a general gloom over the premises, keeping soul and body together to the last upon his savings, for doubtless he spent but half a dime a day, and in the end perhaps outlive me, and claim possession of my office by right of his perpetual occupancy, as all these dark anticipations crowded upon me more and more, and my friends continually intruded their relentless remarks upon the apparition in my room, a great change was wrought in me. I resolved to gather all my faculties together, and forever rid me of this intolerable incubus. Ere revolving any complicated project, however, adapted to this end, I first simply suggested to Bartleby the propriety of his permanent departure. In a calm and serious tone, I commended the idea to his careful and mature consideration. But having taken 3 days to meditate upon it, he apprised me that his original determination remained the same, in short, that he still preferred to abide with me. "What shall I do?" I now said to myself, buttoning up my coat to the last button. "What shall I do? What ought I to do? What does conscience say I should do with this man, or rather ghost? Rid myself of him I must. Go he shall. But how? You will not thrust him, the poor, pale, passive mortal. You will not thrust such a helpless creature out of your door. You will not honor yourself by such cruelty. No, I will not. I cannot do that. Rather would I let him live and die here, and then mason up his remains in the wall. And what then will you do? For all your coaxing, he will not budge. Bribes he leaves under your own paperweight on your table. In short, it is quite plain that he prefers to cling to you. Then something severe, something unusual, must be done. What? Surely you will not have him collared by a constable, and commit his innocent pallor to the common jail? And upon what ground would you procure such a thing to be done? A vagrant, is he? What, he a vagrant, a wanderer, who refuses to budge? It is because he will not be a vagrant, then, that you seek to count him as a vagrant. That is too absurd. No visible means of support. There, I have him. Wrong again, for indubitably he does support himself. And that is the only unanswerable proof that any man can show of his possessing the means so to do. No more, then. Since he will not quit me, I must quit him. I will change my offices. I will move elsewhere, and give him fair notice that if I find him on my new premises, I will then proceed against him as a common trespasser. Acting accordingly, next day, I thus addressed him. I find these chambers too far from the city hall. The air is unwholesome. In a word, I propose to remove my offices next week, and shall no longer require your services. I tell you this now, in order that you may seek another place. He made no reply, and nothing more was said. On the appointed day I engaged carts and men, proceeded to my chambers, and having but little furniture, everything was removed in a few hours. Throughout, the scrivener remained standing behind the screen, which I directed to be removed the last thing. It was withdrawn, and being folded up like a huge folio, left him the motionless occupant of a naked room. I stood in the entry watching him for a moment, while something from within me upbraided me. I re-entered, with my hand in my pocket, and my heart in my mouth. Good-bye, Bartleby. I am going. Good-bye, and God some way bless you. And take that, slipping something in his hand. But it dropped upon the floor, and then, strange to say, I tore myself from him whom I had so longed to be rid of. End of part 3. Part 4 of Bartleby the Scrivener. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Bob Neufeld. Bartleby the Scrivener, A Story of Wall Street, by Herman Melville. Part 4. Established in my new quarters for a day or two, I kept the door locked and started at every footfall in the passages. When I returned to my rooms after any little absence, I would pause at the threshold for an instant and attentively listen ere applying my key. But these fears were needless. Bartleby never came nigh me. I thought all was going well when a perturbed-looking stranger visited me, inquiring whether I was the person who had recently occupied rooms at number Wall Street. Full of forebodings, I replied that I was. "Then, sir," said the stranger, who proved a lawyer, "you are responsible for the man who left there. He refuses to do any copying. He refuses to do anything. He says he prefers not to, and he refuses to quit the premises." "I am very sorry, sir," said I, with assumed tranquillity, but an inward tremor. "But really, the man you allude to is nothing to me. He is no relation or apprentice of mine that you should hold me responsible for him. In mercy's name, who is he?" "I certainly cannot inform you. I know nothing about him. Formerly I employed him as a copyist, but he has done nothing for me now for some time past." "I shall settle him, then. Good morning, sir." Several days passed, and I heard nothing more. And though I often felt a charitable prompting to call at the place and see poor Bartleby, yet a certain squeamishness of I know not what withheld me. "All is over with him by this time," thought I at last, when through another week no further intelligence reached me. But coming to my room the day after, I found several persons waiting at my door in a high state of nervous excitement. "That's the man! Here he comes!" cried the foremost one, whom I recognized as the lawyer who had previously called upon me alone. "You must take him away, sir, at once," cried a portly person among them, advancing upon me, and whom I knew to be the landlord of number Wall Street. "These gentlemen, my tenants, cannot stand it any longer. Mr. B., pointing to the lawyer, "has turned him out of his room, and he now persists in haunting the building generally, sitting upon the banisters of the stairs by day, and sleeping in the entry by night. Everybody is concerned. Clients are leaving the offices. Some fears are entertained of a mob. Something you must do, and that without delay." Aghast at this torrent, I fell back before it, and would fain have locked myself in my new quarters. In vain I persisted that Bartleby was nothing to me, no more than to any one else. In vain. I was the last person known to have anything to do with him, and they held me to the terrible account. Fearful then of being exposed in the papers, as one person presently obscurely threatened, considered the matter, and at length said that if the lawyer would give me a confidential interview with the scrivener, in his, the lawyer's, own room, I would that afternoon strive my best to rid them of the nuisance they complained of. going upstairs to my old haunt, there was Bartleby, silently sitting upon the banister at the landing.
"What are you doing here, Bartleby?"
said I.
"Sitting upon the banister,"
he mildly replied. I motioned him into the lawyer's room, who then left us.
"Bartleby," said I, "are you aware that you are the cause of great tribulation to me by persisting in occupying the entry after being dismissed from the office?"
No answer.
"Now, one of two things must take place. Either you must do something, or something must be done to you. Now, what sort of business would you like to engage in? Would you like to re-engage in copying for someone?"
"No, I would prefer not to make any change."
"Would you like a clerkship in a dry goods store?"
"There is too much confinement about that. No, I would not like a clerkship. But I am not particular."
"Too much confinement?" I cried. "Why, you keep yourself confined all the time."
"I would prefer not to take a clerkship,"
he rejoined, as if to settle that little item at once. "How would a bartender's business suit you? There's no trying of the eyesight in that."
"I would not like it at all, though, as I said before, I am not particular."
His unwonted wordiness inspirited me. I returned to the charge. "Well, then, would you like to travel through the country collecting bills for the merchants? That would improve your health."
"No, I would prefer to be doing something else."
"How, then, would going as a companion to Europe, to entertain some young gentleman with your conversation, how would that suit you?"
"Oh, not at all. It does not strike me that there is anything definite about that. I like to be stationary. But I am not particular."
"Stationary you shall be, then," I cried, now losing all patience, and for the first time in all my exasperating connection with him, fairly flying into a passion. "If you do not go away from these premises before night, I shall feel bound—indeed, I am bound—to quit the premises myself," I rather absurdly concluded, knowing not with what possible threat to try to frighten his immobility into compliance. Despairing of all further efforts, I was precipitately leaving him, when a final thought occurred to me, one which had not been wholly unindulged before. "Bartleby," in the kindest tone I could assume under such exciting circumstances, "will you go home with me now? Not to my office, but my dwelling, and remain there till we can conclude upon some convenient arrangement for you at your leisure? Come, let us start now, right away."
"No, at present I would prefer not to make any change at all."
I answered nothing, but effectually dodging everyone by the suddenness and rapidity of my flight, rushed from the building, ran up Wall Street towards Broadway, and jumping into the first omnibus, was soon removed from pursuit. As soon as tranquillity returned, I distinctly perceived that I had now done all that I possibly could, both in respect to the demands of the landlord and his tenants, and with regard to my own desire and sense of duty to benefit Bartleby and shield him from rude persecution. I now strove to be entirely care-free and quiescent, and my conscience justified me in the attempt, though indeed it was not so successful as I could have wished. So fearful was I of being again hunted out by the incensed landlord and his exasperated tenants, that, surrendering my business to Nippers for a few days, I drove about the upper part of the town and through the suburbs in my rockaway, crossed over to Jersey City and Hoboken, and paid fugitive visits to Manhattanville and Astoria. In fact, I almost lived in my Rockaway for the time. When again I entered my office, lo, a note from the landlady lay upon the desk. I opened it with trembling hands.
It informed me that the writer had sent to the police, and had Bartleby removed to the Tombs as a vagrant. Moreover, since I knew more about him than any one else, he wished me to appear at that place and make a suitable statement of the facts. These tidings had a conflicting effect upon me. At first I was indignant, but at last almost approved. The landlord's energetic, summary disposition had led him to adopt a procedure which I do not think I would have decided upon myself. And yet, as a last resort, under such peculiar circumstances, it seemed the only plan. As I afterwards learned, the poor scrivener, when told that he must be conducted to the Tombs, offered not the slightest obstacle, but in his pale, unmoving way, silently acquiesced. Some of the compassionate and curious bystanders joined the party, and headed by one of the constables arm in arm with Bartleby, the silent procession filed its way through all the noise and heat and joy of the roaring thoroughfares at noon. The same day I received the note I went to the Tombs, or to speak more properly, the Halls of Justice. Seeking the right officer, I stated the purpose of my call, and was informed that the individual I described was indeed within. I then assured the functionary that Bartleby was a perfectly honest man, and greatly to be compassionated, however unaccountably eccentric. I narrated all I knew, and closed by suggesting the idea of letting him remain in as indulgent confinement as possible till something less harsh might be done, though indeed I hardly knew what. At all events, if nothing else could be decided upon, the almshouse must receive him. I then begged to have an interview. Being under no disgraceful charge, and quite serene and harmless in all his ways, they had permitted him freely to wander about the prison, and especially in the enclosed grass-platted yard thereof. And so I found him there, standing all alone in the quietest of the yards, his face towards a high wall, while all around, from the narrow slits of the jail windows, I thought I saw peering out upon him the eyes of murderers and thieves. "Bartleby, I know you," he said, without looking round, "and I want nothing to say to you." "It was not I that brought you here, Bartleby," said I, keenly pained at his implied suspicion. "And to you this should not be so vile a place. Nothing reproachful attaches to you by being here. And see, it is not so sad a place as one might think. Look, there is the sky, and here is the grass." "I know where I am," he replied, but would say nothing more. So I left him. As I entered the corridor again, a broad, meat-like man in an apron accosted me, and jerking his thumb over his shoulder, said, "Is that your friend?" "Yes." "Does he want to starve? If he does, let him live on the prison fare, that's all." "Who are you?" asked I, not knowing what to make of such an unofficially speaking person in such a place. "I am the grub-man. Such gentlemen as have friends here hire me to provide them with something good to eat." "Is this so?" said I, turning to the turnkey. He said it was. "Well, then," said I, slipping some silver into the grub-man's hands, for so they called him, "I want you to give particular attention to my friend there. Let him have the best dinner you can get, and you must be as polite to him as possible." "Introduce me, will you?" said the grub-man, looking at me with an expression which seemed to say he was all impatience for an opportunity to give a specimen of his breeding. Thinking it would prove of benefit to the scrivener, I acquiesced, and, asking the grub-man his name, went up with him to Bartleby. "Bartleby, this is Mr. Cutlets. You will find him very useful to you." "Your servant, sir, your servant," said the grubman, making a low salutation behind his apron. Hope you find it pleasant here, sir. Spacious grounds, cool apartments, sir. Hope you'll stay with us some time. But try to make it agreeable. May Mrs. Cutlets and I have the pleasure of your company to dinner, sir, in Mrs. Cutlets' private room?
I prefer not to dine today, said Bartleby, turning away. It would disagree with me. I am unused to dinners.
So saying, he slowly moved to the other side of the enclosure, and took up a position fronting the dead wall. How's this? Said the grubman, addressing me with a stare of astonishment. He's odd, ain't he?
I think he is a little deranged, said I, sadly.
Deranged? Deranged, is it? Well, now, upon my word, I thought that friend of yourn was a gentleman forger. They are always pale and genteel-like, them forgers. I can't pity him. Can't help it, sir. Did you know Monroe Edwards? He added touchingly, and paused. Then, laying his hand pityingly on my shoulder, sighed, He died of consumption at Sing Sing. So you weren't acquainted with Monroe?
No, I was never socially acquainted with any forgers. But I cannot stop longer. Look to my friend yonder. You will not lose by it. I will see you again.
Some few days after this, I again obtained admission to the tombs, and went through the corridors in quest of Bartleby, but without finding him.
I saw him coming from his cell not long ago, said a turnkey. Maybe he's gone to loiter in the yards. So I went in that direction.
Are you looking for the silent man?
Said another turnkey, passing me. Yonder he lies, sleeping in the yard there. 'Tis not 20 minutes since I saw him lie down. The yard was entirely quiet. It was not accessible to the common prisoners. The surrounding walls, of amazing thickness, kept off all sounds behind them. The Egyptian character of the masonry weighed upon me with its gloom. But a soft, imprisoned turf grew underfoot. The heart of the eternal pyramids, it seemed, wherein by some strange magic, through the clefts, grass seed dropped by birds had sprung. Strangely huddled at the base of the wall, his knees drawn up, and lying on his side, his head touching the cold stones, I saw the wasted Bartleby. But nothing stirred. I paused, then went close up to him, stooped over, and saw that his dim eyes were open. Otherwise he seemed profoundly sleeping. Something prompted me to touch him. I felt his hand, when a tingling shiver ran up my arm and down my spine to my feet. The round face of the grubman peered upon me now.
His dinner is ready. Won't he dine today either? Or does he live without dining?
Lives without dining, said I, and closed his eyes.
Aye, he's asleep, ain't he?
With kings and counselors, murmured I. There would seem little need of proceeding further in this history. Imagination will readily supply the meagre recital of poor Bartleby's interment. But, ere parting with the reader, let me say that if this little narrative has sufficiently interested him to awaken curiosity as to who Bartleby was, and what manner of life he led prior to the present narrator's making his acquaintance, I can only reply that in such curiosity I fully share, but am wholly unable to gratify it. Yet here I hardly know whether I should divulge one little item of rumour which came to my ear a few months after the scrivener's decease. Upon what basis it rested, I could never ascertain, and hence how true it is I cannot now tell. But inasmuch as this vague report has not been without certain strange, suggestive interest to me, however sad, it may prove the same with some others, and so I will briefly mention it.
The report was this: that Bartleby had been a subordinate clerk in the dead letter office at Washington, from which he had been suddenly removed by a change in the administration. When I think over this rumor, I cannot adequately express the emotions which seize me. Dead letters! Does it not sound like dead men? Conceive a man by nature and misfortune prone to a pallid hopelessness. Can any business seem more fitted to heighten it than that of continually handling these dead letters and assorting them for the flames? For by the cartload they are annually burned. Sometimes from out the folded paper the pale clerk takes a ring. The finger it was meant for, perhaps, moulders in the grave. A banknote sent in swiftest charity. He whom it would relieve nor eats nor hungers any more. Pardon for those who died despairing, hope for those who died unhoping, good tidings for those who died stifled by unrelieved calamities. On errands of life, these letters speed to death. Ah, Bartleby! Ah, humanity! End of part 4. End of Bartleby the Scrivener, A Story of Wall Street, by Herman Melville.
Save on O'Reilly Brake Parts Cleaner. Get 2 cans of O'Reilly Brake Parts Cleaner for just $8. Valid in-store only at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.